Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Mother's Day to you. If you don't know me, my name is Luke. I'm on our pastoral team here. And if you have a Bible with you, you can open up to Mark chapter 13. That's where we're going to be today in our journey through Mark. I was thinking back to last year, because last Mother's Day, 2014, I was sharing the sermon as well. And we were in a weird place in the book of Mark at that point. We picked this really, you know, appropriate passage for Mother's Day, which was the beheading of John the Baptist. And it's just where we fell, and it was kind of odd, but there was a mother in it. She wasn't a very good one, but we're kind of in that spot again as you turn to Mark chapter 13. We're in an interesting place in Mark, a bit of a turning point in Mark. And Mark 13 is, if you have a physical Bible with you and it's one of those red letter ones, you're going to see right away that Mark 13 is this long speech from Jesus. Now, this is actually the longest speech from Jesus in the entire gospel. So that should tell us something. It should probably tell us to pay a little bit of attention. Now, Jesus in this speech is going to be talking about the future, things that are on the way. But we're reading Mark as a historical document, something from the past. So I have predictably and appropriately titled this teaching, Back to the Future, just because we can. And we're going to be in Mark 13 this week and Mark 13 next week, and I'm going to guide us through the whole chapter together, and we're breaking it up into two parts. And so the first this week is what to expect when you're expecting. Throwing a little Mother's Day in there for you. And then part two will be next week onward into the time in between the trees. So we're going to break it up. It's important to cover this as much as we can in one lump sum. There's parts of Mark that are appropriate for us to break down into smaller sections. Last week would be a really good example of that when we looked at the story of the widow and her offering. It kind of breaks into a small story and we can unpack it. There's a few verses there. There's other parts of Mark that are bigger sections that are appropriate to walk through together, like a long speech from Jesus. So we're going to try and do all that in the next 2 weeks together. As I said, this is the longest speech that Jesus has in the book of Mark. And he's going to spend a lot of time talking about what the future is going to look like. Some people call this the end times. Some people call this the last days. And some people have a lot of ideas about those kinds of things, about the end times, about the last days. You know, there's a sense we saw in two. You can go to the next slide there, John. That'd be great. 2012 was an interesting year where there was all kinds of speculation about what was going to happen that year. Some Mayan prophecies, some perspectives, some interesting books and documents written and shows made about this kind of a thing. And we find this especially in Christian culture to be a topic of great interest. The future. What's going to happen in the future? Or what some people call the end times. Or what some people call the last days. And it's become this like millions and millions of dollar industry of people writing books and making movies. And really, a lot of the time and a lot of the content that comes out of this thinking is really speculation. Well, what we're going to get to do in the next few weeks is actually walk through what Jesus has to say about the future and begin with him and maybe get away from a lot of that speculation and begin to think clearly about what we understand the future to look like according to Jesus. I'm going to throw the next slide up here as we start into the next 2 weeks as a bit of a direction for us in understanding the biblical narrative in its entirety as the Bible understands history and as the Bible understands past. This is really basic, but it might be helpful for some of us to whom some of this stuff is new. When we look at the biblical narrative, on one side of it, we have creation, and early on, we have the fall. And then in the middle of history, the cross, the dividing point, the key point in history, we have Jesus' death and resurrection. You can see down here, before the cross, before Jesus comes, we've got what we would understand to be the Old Testament scriptural writings. And then after the cross, we have what we understand to be the New Testament writings, as well as the time that we're living in now. Because we live after the cross and the resurrection, but we live before the time where Jesus returns and the new creation occurs, where heaven and earth combine and everything that is wrong is actually made right. So we live in that space. Some people have called this time the time between the trees. Because what we have in that dividing point in history is a cross, a tree. And then at the end, when Jesus returns and we speak of the new creation, we have a passage in Revelation 22 which describes this glorious holy city where God and we dwell. In the middle of that city is what's called the tree of life. And out of the tree of life flow these rivers. And these are illustrations, these are pictures that John writes to us to help us kind of get an illustration or idea of what everything will look like when God puts everything right that's actually wrong, what the new creation will look like, what heaven will be like when it's fully here. So people have called that, because of the tree of life and the cross, the time between the trees. And that's the time where we live. Now, it's an interesting time to be in because we are reflecting on the New Testament, on the scriptures that we have on our hands, and we're also looking forward. Now, when we're looking into the scriptures, sometimes the scriptures talk about the future. But from the scriptural perspective, in the time that it is written, it's actually speaking of our past. Are you with me? So the person writing or speaking, let's take Jesus for example, is speaking about the future, but in some instances, because those things have already happened in 2,000 years, we're on the other side of his future. We're actually looking back at those things, and they're technically in the past. But there are other times in the scriptures, other times also when Jesus is speaking, that he's actually speaking about things that are beyond our current present state where we are right now. Things that are connected to the future. And that's what we're going to discover in Mark 13. Some points when Jesus is talking about stuff that's actually already happened, and some points where we're going to see these things are actually still yet to come. Some time has elapsed, but it's still on the way. So what we're going to do now is look into Mark, into the past, to learn a little bit about the future. Let's begin. This morning we're going to walk through verses 1 through 13 together. As Jesus was leaving the temple that day, now remember the previous scene, right? He's been teaching in the temple. He's been specifically referencing and directing the attention of disciples to the widow and her story and her offering. She gave everything. And Leanne talked about that last week. If you missed that sermon, I encourage you to listen to it. It's fantastic. As Jesus was leaving the temple that day, one of his disciples said, "Teacher, look at these magnificent buildings. Look at the impressive stones in the walls." Jesus replied, "Yes, look at these great buildings, but they will be completely demolished. Not one stone will be left on top of another." So Jesus leaves the temple for the last time. Over the past few weeks, we've seen him go in and out of the temple multiple times. This is the final time where he's going to leave. And really, in this moment, he's in very much way turning his back on the temple. He's had run-ins with the temple leadership, and now this is it. This is the breaking point. As they're leaving, the disciples marvel, or they're amazed, at the greatness of the temple. This is characteristic of the disciples. They're impressed by big, flashy things, right? They're impressed with power. They're obsessed with authority and power and control. And so they look at this great structure and they're like, look at this thing. It's phenomenal. And it was. It's one of the 7 or 9 wonders of the ancient world. A phenomenal, phenomenal thing. But Jesus wasn't concerned, as we've seen in different passages in the last few weeks, with outer appearances, is he? Jesus cares about essence. Jesus cares about nature. He cares about character, not necessarily outer appearances. Although the temple looked really good, ultimately it was corrupt. And Jesus has spoken this earlier, and we're going to see this again in his teaching now, that the temple is going to be replaced by him and his followers. So what he does in this passage, he actually predicts the destruction of the temple. And this is a historical fact. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD, 30, 40 years after Jesus said these words. There was a Jewish revolt, and that began the Jewish-Roman Wars. That revolt started in 66 AD, and the Romans rolled in, and they destroyed Jerusalem, and they destroyed the temple. So that's not too long after Jesus was living. So he's speaking of a historical reality, but this is one of those moments in Scripture, one of those moments when Jesus is speaking, when a historical reality and a theological reality actually come together and meet. Jesus was speaking of the actual literal destruction of the temple, but he's also speaking of the temple's removal from the center of Jewish worship. The future resting place, as Jesus has already said, and this prophecy again speaks to, the future resting place for God's Spirit wouldn't be housed in stone after the cross and resurrection. It would be housed in flesh, in people, in his followers. And so we can see another description of this when we look back into Mark 12, and Jesus teaches and tells the story about the parable of the evil tenant farmers. He says, things are going to change. The system is corrupt, it's wrong, and God is going to make right what is actually wrong. So the temple's destruction wasn't literally just in that historical, literal sense. The authority and presence of God would now be housed in humans. The temple would be replaced by temples, by you and I. And really, what this does is it takes us back, in many ways, to the beginning of the story. It takes us back to Genesis, where we see God creates man and woman, and he puts his image on and in them. And then the fall happens, and things get screwed up, and a system occurs, a means of grace. The law is given, the temple functions for a period of time. But after the cross and resurrection, again we see this connection, this kinship of God saying, I am in you. My presence is on you and in you. My image is on you and in you. And Jesus is speaking to what's about to happen as the cross and his resurrection gets closer. He continues to say this in verse 3. Later, Jesus sat on the Mount of Olives across the valley from the temple. So he's left the city, he's sitting outside of it, and he's looking at it, sitting on a hill, looking at the city. Imagine that picture. Peter, James, John, and Andrew, so probably the two sets of brothers, came to him privately and asked him, tell us, when will all this happen? What sign will show us that these things are about to be fulfilled? So Jesus left the city, he's looking at the temple. The future resting place, as he said, is no longer this place. It is actually going to be different than that. And at this point, the inner circle come to Jesus and they ask him about when these things are going to happen. Now remember, Jesus is talking about destruction and change. And he's talking about a shift. Oftentimes throughout his speaking, his disciples are interpreting it differently than he means. They're still thinking a lot of the time that Jesus is perhaps a military leader about to lead a rebellion. So their question in many ways could be interpreted, Jesus, when are things going to kick off? When do we pull out the swords? When are you going to do the lighting up like a Christmas tree thing at the Transfiguration on that hill? When are you going to do that? When's the cue? They might be asking that. So Jesus' following words are specifically to them, to these four guys who are gathered, his inner circle that are around him. They're not for the general crowds. The words aren't for the people that oppose him, but they're meant to prepare his devoted disciples. And so his intent in these words is threefold, really preparation, warning, and encouragement. Preparation, warning, and encouragement. Mark is recording these words 20, 30 years later, maybe, writing them down for the Christians of his day that are actually experiencing much of what Jesus is describing in Mark chapter 13, much of what he's predicted. So as we read chapter 13, it's important to keep in mind that Mark hasn't written these words, and Jesus didn't speak these words so that we can speculate and write Christian movies and books about what the end times are going to look like. They haven't necessarily written or spoken these things so that we can have a clear, didactic, straightforward timeline of exactly how things are going to happen and who's who in the story. The intent of these words is warning, prediction, encouragement. That's the whole point. There's an essence of wanting to prepare the disciples for something. So the focus as we walk through chapter 13 is not necessarily go, okay, exactly how is everything going to work out? It's more going, what is Jesus preparing them for and why is he preparing them? What's their role going to be in the midst of it? And as we read it, what's our role in the midst of it? If we begin to kind of speculate and drop timelines and say that Oprah's the Antichrist and all this kind of stuff, to be honest with you, we're gonna get away from Jesus, we're gonna get away from the scriptures, and it might be kind of interesting and sexy, but to be honest with you, it's not scriptural. So we're gonna try and stay with what Jesus has to say. And he says this in verse 5. Jesus replied, "Don't let anyone mislead you, for many will come in my name claiming I am the Messiah. They will deceive many, and you will hear of wars and threats of wars, but don't panic. Yes, these things must take place, but the end won't follow immediately. Nation will go to war against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in many parts of the world as well as famines, but this is only the first of the birth pains with more to come." Some more Mother's Day thrown in there for you, birth pains, right? Right? The Lord knows. He lines it all up. So it's clear from his words that a lot, apparently, is about to happen. Specifically, other leaders are going to come along after Jesus, self-proclaimed messiahs, liberators, maybe, for the Jewish nation. They had come before Jesus, self-proclaimed messiahs. We know that historically. And there's people that came after Jesus, self-proclaimed messiahs. What Jesus wants them to understand is that he is different than these people. His intent is not political. The freedom that he's going to bring is so much bigger than they could possibly understand, bigger than their situation politically that they're in that moment, different from all the others. And this is important for us to consider and understand that Jesus is different, that God's way is different, that the gospel is different than the way the world does it in a lot of different ways. And I think actually Mother's Day is a really wonderful way to consider that. I was sitting at the back just during the music, and if you sit at the back, you always see parents dealing with their kids. And specifically, you know, watching moms deal with their kids. And there's this level of kindness and this level of generosity, which is really quite beautiful and interesting to watch. And that really is, very much so, part of the image of God. In 1 Thessalonians, we read Paul, who says, "But we were gentle among you, like a nursing mother that tenderly cares for her children, imparting to you not just the gospel, but our very lives." And this essence is not naturally Paul's. This is the guy who kills Christians. This is the guy who's got a pretty intent mission. Even once he's become a Christian, he can be viewed as pretty hard-nosed. But he says, look, when we came to town and we ministered amongst you, we were gentle, like a nursing mother tenderly cares. What kind of image is that? That's a different kind of leadership than we often see throughout the world, isn't it? Different kind of leadership. And we're all trying to understand that. So Jesus says in this moment, just understand there's going to be people that come along claiming the same things that I claim, but they're doing things differently than God really does them. God is different in this way. There's a gentleness and a humility to his service. He then goes on to sort of reference this general calamity in the world, a lot of turmoil. And much of what he's describing has already happened in the life of the disciples when we look back into the book of Acts. Acts 11, we see that a famine has been described. We hear of earthquakes in Acts, and we know that all through history, all these things are happening all of the time. In many ways, Jesus is saying that this stuff is going to be going on, but it doesn't necessarily mean that things are getting worse. It might mean that we're moving to something better. We see this hardship still actually continuing today. Jesus used the words birth pains. And this kind of language was familiar to Jewish people. It was a language that was typically used in the Old Testament strictly for God's judgment on Israel and other nations. And so he uses the image of labor in describing in what the world will go through before the end, before the ultimate judgment, calling these the birth pains. Now, this is good news. Why is this good news? Well, if there's birth pains, what does that imply? A birth. There's going to be something good that comes to the end of this, hopefully. There's going to be something good. There's going to be a child. There's going to be a rebirth. There's going to be something new, something to look forward to. Even though it's challenging, something good is going to come out of it. So previously, this language is only associated with God's judgment. But in the context of this narrative through Mark, what we see is a laborer is going to lead to a delivery. And that delivery language kind of works in lots of different ways for us, doesn't it? When we look back to Exodus and try and understand Jesus as he's understanding the new Exodus that he's bringing as we walk through Mark, this labor is going to bring a delivery. God is going to judge the world, but he's also delivering it. He's also bringing liberty and freedom. And all this is going to fully happen when Jesus returns at the end of the age. So remember that previous chart. If we can go to that again, John, that would be great. We're in the middle of the birth pains. We live here in this section. And though that's challenging, we've seen salvation occur. We've seen deliverance occur. But this is the already but not yet of the kingdom that some people have described. You might have heard that before. The kingdom is here, but it's also on the way. It's not fully here yet. We're waiting for that new creation. In the midst of that waiting, there are these birth pains that Jesus is describing. Verse 9. When these things begin to happen, Jesus says, watch out. We're going to hear that phrase, watch out or be alert, a lot through this passage. So when Jesus says, watch out, watch out. You will be handed over to local councils and beaten in the synagogues. You will stand trial before governors and kings because you are my followers. But this will be your opportunity to tell them about me. For the good news must first be preached to all nations. But when you are arrested and stand trial, don't worry in advance about what to say. Just say what God tells you at that time. For it is not you who will be speaking, but the Holy Spirit. So Jesus predicts much of what we see in the book of Acts, especially what's going to happen to these disciples. They're going to get in trouble. They're going to get arrested. They're going to get put on trial. And so this is probably speaking to that chunk of time, right? I don't know this week if many of us have been dragged into synagogues and put on trial, right? This is probably more applying to them. So Jesus says that the persecution and challenge, however, isn't necessarily something bad, though it is difficult, but an opportunity to talk about the gospel, to point to him. Now, isn't that an interesting thought? And you see this come up all throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. Paul speaks quite a lot about it. The early Christians understood this, that when we experience hardship and challenge, do we view it as God's displeasure with us or as something to avoid? Or are these opportunities to allow God's grace and mission to flow through our lives, for God's story to be displayed through our story? See, back in the ancient world, if something went wrong in somebody's life, somebody had a bad experience, they had an illness or somebody hurt them, they might look at that and say, well, clearly the gods hate you. Clearly, based on your outer situation, things are going horribly wrong for you and you're a bad person and you need to get your stuff together, right? So what Jesus is speaking to here is like when those bad things happen, understand that might not be a note that something's wrong. It actually might mean that we're moving towards something right, and God might use that might use that to display his nature and character in you, to give you a chance to share his story. People still do that today, don't they? Life's not going well. Ever notice how Christians do that all the while? Like something goes really well, oh, God is good, I just feel so blessed. And then something doesn't go well, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my goodness, the world is falling apart. And though you don't say it in the back of your head, you're like, come on, God, what, like, were you like with me yesterday, but not today? This is one of those moments, though it's through the lens of understanding persecution, which we don't always get, understanding that challenge can actually be something that God uses more than success. His story can bleed through our story in beautiful, interesting ways. How can God's story be displayed through ours in moments of challenge? As we've already seen in Mark, also, the gospel is intended, as Jesus says, to go out to all nations. It's supposed to go to everybody. God has come to give life and liberation and deliverance not only to Jewish people, but to everything, to everybody. The gospel is going to oust wayward and corrupt systems, harmful thinking that exploits people like the widow that we saw in the previous passage. So you remember that? Jesus is not happy about what happens to the widow. And so when he says the gospel's got to go to all the nations, he's not just thinking of the Jewish widows. He's thinking of every widow. He's thinking of every person. We've seen this all through Mark. Different people of socioeconomic classes, different nationalities, women, children, all people coming together at Jesus saying God actually loves them all. Saw a great example of this the other night. I was in Vancouver for a benefit for an organization that does education in Rwanda and Burundi. And they're doing phenomenal work. It's an organization that primarily works through education, training teachers, training schools, and they're just impacting thousands of teachers and thousands of kids, and their aim is to transform the young generation so that when these young Rwandans and Burundians grow up, they actually are going to transform their country and how they lead. And if you know the history of those two nations, you know that that country needs strong, good leadership. This is a Christian organization. They're not just doing it because they believe in education. They're doing it because they believe that Jesus said, go everywhere. Go everywhere. So that's why we have global work. That's why we give our money. That's why we're trying to plant churches. That's why we're trying to talk about what it means to be a Christian in our workplaces and our neighborhoods. It's because Jesus says this is for everybody. Somebody did that for us. You might not know it or not, but you're not in Israel right now, right? You don't live in the Holy Land. You live on the west coast of British Columbia. Somebody brought the gospel somewhere, and we're experiencing that. And that mantle, that torch, is actually passed on to every single Christian. It continues to unfold. It has to spread because God loves everybody so much, as we read that in the book of John especially. And so these disciples are going to be sent out places where others have gone. Roads? Where we're going, we don't need roads. There's like four of you that got the Back to the Future reference, and I applaud you for that. So these men are entrusted with the gospel. They're aided by God's Spirit when they're put to the test. Right? Jesus says you're going to be put in difficult situations, but know that it's God's Spirit working through you. You're not going to do this by yourself. You're his temple. His presence is in you and on you. We see a great example of this in Acts 4:13. Right away, Peter and John pulled before the Sanhedrin, and they are about to be scourged or killed. They don't really know. These are the same people that had Jesus killed. And this is the same Peter who denied Jesus and ran away, crying. And yet, they're standing in front of them, and they boldly proclaim the gospel and the truth to them because God's Spirit is working through them. And what does the Sanhedrin say? These people have been with Jesus. They can tell. The same Spirit on and in Jesus is a Spirit that's on and in them, God's Spirit. So these simple people are welcomed into this bigger story. And isn't that an encouraging thought? That these bumbling, stumbling, spiritually simple-minded band of misfits can be released into the wild with God's good news for all people, and he's going to give them everything that they need for the mission. that even though they're a bit scared of what he's calling them into, maybe like what Tiffany described, he's going to give them everything they need for what he's calling them into. When things get wobbly, God gets to work. You can write that on your arm if you need to this week. A brother will betray his brother to death, verse 12. A father will betray his own child, and children will rebel against their parents and cause them to be killed. And everyone will hate you because you are my followers. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. So Jesus goes on to describe that things are going to get chaotic. Things are going to get challenging. The gospel is good news, but it's going to create upheaval in the world. It's going to bring transformation. And this is an important note. The gospel is disruptive. When it really is transforming and working through a community, it is disruptive. When the kingdom is en route and the king is about to return, all the other little kings and kingdoms are fighting for their place at the throne, aren't they? The disciples understood this quite literally. They're persecuted, they're put to death, they were tortured, they were imprisoned. And many Christians around the world still experience this. We might not experience it exactly like that. Persecution might look different here. But if the gospel is to truly transform a community, it's going to mean that there will be some level of pushback because people hold on to their idols. We see a great example of that in Acts 16, verses 16 through 40, when Paul and Silas go to Philippi. Remember, and there's this girl who can tell the future, and she's walking around, and she's distracting people with all her shouting, so they cast the demon out. Then the person that owns her is really ticked off, because that was the cash cow that they were living off of. And so then they get dragged in front of the council. They get dragged in front of the authorities of the town, and people are ticked off because when the gospel comes to town, the idols get ousted. When the king comes to town, the little kings have to submit. And sometimes that's not a popular thing. When the gospel comes to town, it has social, economic, and political ramifications. The gospel isn't just an ethereal ideal or experience, because God cares about people, real people. And people live in the real world. And the gospel transforms the real world. And sometimes the real world doesn't want to transform. So Jesus points to that. He says there's going to be extreme tension. There's going to be challenge. Be prepared. Be prepared for that. Understand that that tension isn't necessarily you coming in and forcing people to do things. Remember, we look back earlier into the passage. How does God do things? How does he call us to live selflessly and with humility? But even as we're doing that, we're going to come up against pushback often. So then we come to this part in the passage that is one of Jesus' most encouraging statements in all of the Gospels, a wonderful motivation for becoming a Christian. Everyone will hate you because you are my followers. How's that for trying to start a movement? Come and follow me. Well, what do I get out of it? Well, you get access to the Most High God, a tote bag, and everybody's going to hate you because you are my followers. I don't know if they were printing t-shirts back then, that would have been a good thing to print on it. But let's return to the previous story before this, the story of the widow and her offering, in order to use that as sort of a vehicle of understanding Jesus' words here. Following Jesus costs us something. Following Jesus costs us something. Jesus gives everything. That's what the cross is about. Jesus gives everything. And he looks to his disciples and he says, follow my lead. Or as we saw earlier in Mark, simply pick up your cross and follow me. And so what does being a Christian cost? Cost the love of money? Cost the love of pride? The love of control? Sometimes it costs the love of popular opinion, Jesus says. It costs us everything in order to really, truly gain everything. And Jesus is later actually going to be crucified, and he's going to be nailed to the cross, and he's going to say in that moment, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. Jesus understood that in that moment, the soldiers that were crucifying him, there was a level of misunderstanding. Did they know they were killing their God in that moment? Did they know they were driving the nails into the hands and the feet of their God in that moment? This is a moment of misunderstanding. And sometimes misunderstanding can be one of the most painful things in the entire world. You ever been misunderstood? Somebody thinks something of you that just isn't true or right, or they misunderstand how you've acted or said something. It hurts, doesn't it? It hurts. Jesus says, prepare for that. But just know that if you're going to hold on to something, don't hold on to the love of money. Don't hold on to even popular approval or opinion of other people, but hold on to the God who loves you, the God who loves all people, who's come to give everything for you, the God who's put his image on you, that's made you his temple. That's what Jesus calls them to. And so the encouragement is at the end of this passage that as we trustingly put our whole lives into the offering plate, like the widow, as Leanne said brilliantly last week, when we do that, we know we won't be forgotten. And it's a better thing to trust the God who made us than the love of money or the approval of other people, is it not? But Jesus is calling us back to, like, think about who you are and just remember to trust. Know that as you put everything out there, you will not be forgotten by this God. The one who endures to the end will be saved. Jesus says, hold on. Though there's birth pains that are going to happen, they're going to signal the disruption and the rightful king's arrival, stay faithful. Trust his kingship. Trust his way of humility, service, and love, and we will come out the other side eventually into a new world. So, as we wrap up here, thank you for your patience. Just a few things for us to take out of the passage. What can we walk away with today? A few thoughts and then a couple of questions. First, we are God's temple. You are God's temple. So how does that reality inform how you see yourself? And how does that change how you live? Wrestle with that. If there's one question, actually, that I'd love for you to wrestle with, it's that one. You are God's temple, and how does that change how you see yourself and how you live? Another thing we can see is that God's Spirit is different than we might think. It's humble, selfless, it's loving. It's not like other messiahs or kings. So what systems and patterns do you follow? And is this the way of Jesus, or is it a subpar knockoff? There's lots of people that come along proclaiming the way or the right way, and that still happens in our culture today, and it might look right to an extent, but we have to be diligent, especially as we look at ideologies and philosophies and systems and behavior and ways of thinking. It's like, is this got Jesus at the center? Is this emanating from him, or is it a subpar knockoff? We're going to be led astray if we're not cautious of that. Next, God's Spirit is in us for a reason to deliver the good news about deliverance. So a question for us this week is, what prisoners surround you, and how can you point them to freedom? As we consider that humility and selflessness of Jesus and living in that character, how can we point the people around us that we know are living in captivity? How can we point them to Jesus in a humble and a selfless way? And then finally, God's Spirit will give us what we need for where we're sent. So the question would be, how can you trust God and step into moments of courage as you point to the truth, as you point to freedom? How can you just trust him like the widow, walking out in that step of faith in a moment and knowing that the Spirit's going to work through you? You're not going to have to do it by yourself. The Spirit's going to work through you. So the conclusion of that would simply be, get ready for the adventure and hold on to the hope. Really as simple as that. That takes us to the middle, really, of chapter 13. And then next week, we're going to move onward into the time in between the trees as we can cover more of that. Thanks for your patience. Let me just pray as we close. Jesus, this was big stuff for Peter and Andrew, James and John to get their heads around when they were listening to you say this, and it's big stuff for us. And I pray this morning that we would hear the truth in love, that we'd know what you've called us into, that we'd sense where you're guiding us, and we'd be encouraged that your Spirit is in us, that we are your living temples out there, a place where people can look to and understand how to worship God, understand how to know God. What is God like? May they be able to look at us this week, Jesus. I pray we'll be able to walk like you and live like you in grace and humility, in selflessness. I pray these things in Jesus' name. And everyone said, amen. Bless you as you go. Thanks for your patience. Happy Mother's Day. Give a mother an extra special high five or fist bump.